So I feel bad. I didn't actually write a cold open for this episode.
Well, you don't need to.
Why? I mean,
this is the Sam Jackson episode of Junk Food Cinema. True. If ever there was a layup in the history of a Junk Food Cinema episode where you could just like press the button, hit record, do the opening thing, and we would just fucking talk for like ever.
Yeah.
This would be that episode.
Yeah. Plus, no matter what speech I write, he would just have a better one waiting.
He really would.
Yeah.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Hey, everybody, welcome back to a great damn motherfucking episode of Junk Food Cinema right here.
I don't remember asking you a goddamn thing.
What? What ain't no podcast I ever heard of? Is what on Stitcher? Actually, we are.
What is on Stitcher?
What is on Stitcher is Junk Food Cinema, FSR's weekly cult and exploitation film cast, hosted by myself, Brian Salisbury, and my good friend here, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
And, yeah, you can find us.
Forgot to mention novelist and screenwriter, C. Robert. That's in my
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
That's in my fucking contract. And we don't have contracts, but we are probably going to drop a lot of F-bombs in this episode, if such a thing offends you, because we are talking about Samuel L. motherfucking Jackson.
The man who perfected the word motherfucker.
Morpheus, if you remember correctly. Do you not recall the Samuel L. Jackson whole I'm not Lawrence Fishburne thing for like the last year?
Okay, yeah. No, I was like, Cargo's been hit on the
head.
He's
gone around for a year wearing a t-shirt saying I'm not Lawrence Fishburne.
How do people still get them confused? I'm so, that messes with my head a little bit.
Fucking white people.
Fucking white people, right? You can also find us on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/motherfucking junk food cinema.
I don't think that'll actually come up.
No.
I think that's an error.
That's probably a 404.
404 fucking not found.
When you absolutely positively have to get to the best podcast in the room, accept no substitutes. Is this just going to be the whole podcast? Is just quoting?
I told you it was a fucking layup.
It's a total layup.
I was not kidding. Like, this is.
If there was ever
an episode we had to do no research for, it's the Samuel L. Jackson episode. Like,
I don't know why I bothered to do research.
Fucking Samuel L. Jackson showed up to Butnumathon this year, and the crowd lost its mind like we have never lost our mind in the 16-year history of Butnumathon. Like, it was, we have had some amazing people walk into that room. We've had Peter Jackson walk in bringing us Return of the King. We have had, Mel Gibson come in with Passion of the Christ. Fucking Samuel L. Jackson comes in with Kingsman, and everybody loses their god damn mind and turns into an 8-year-old fucking boy screaming, going, oh my god, it's Samuel L. Jackson. Like, this is this guy, the films that he's been involved with, the work that he's done, the presence that he's brought to films, he is one of the driving forces of our generation's of our generation's cinema. You know, he's been part of so many big things. Like, we could do this episode of just his most important films and his biggest films, and there'd be no reason to listen to them because you have hours and hours of your own opinions on them. Like, you know, talking about Jurassic Park and mm-hmm. Pulp Fiction and just all of these films that he's been a part of that are just so just entrenched in cinema history.
Yeah.
He's just a force of nature, and we have these films committed to memory. We know them by heart, and so do you. But there's some that you may have missed. There's some that deserve special attention, mm-hmm. and that's what we're going to talk about today.
And here's why Samuel L. Jackson is an interesting subject for this, our series on our favorite black character actors. I told someone that we were going to be, I can't remember who it was, but I told someone that we were going to be focusing on Sam Jackson for an episode, and they were like, as a character actor, really? And I'm like, yeah, because throughout 90% of his career, that's exactly what he's done.
Yeah.
And, you know,
he's rarely the lead in films. And when he is, it's not always the greatest films. You know, sometimes it's stuff like with Eugene Levy in The Man.
Awful.
Or it's, you know, fun like Snakes on a Plane.
Awesome.
But awesome.
Bad, but awesome.
Yes. But you know.
Super bad, but super awesome.
Yeah. No, he's somebody you bring in because he brings a level of flavor and dominance to a role that you end up putting him on the poster, even though he's in 5 minutes of the movie, which is one of the movies we're going to fucking talk about tonight.
But here's what is so great about Snakes on a Plane and why it epitomizes this entire discussion is because I feel like that movie was made on a dare. I feel like that movie was Samuel L. Jackson realizing that he had achieved a level of pop culture recognition that he could literally open a movie that was called Snakes on a Plane, whose plot went no further than reciting the title Snakes on a Plane. And he's like, and this movie will make millions of dollars. And if you don't believe me, just watch the fucking thing, because I will do it.
Well, no, I mean, I remember when this happened, because Snakes on a Plane was a weird kind of culture bomb. It's a strange thing in that he got the script and he just saw the title. He said, I'm making this fucking movie. Like, it was one of those stupid things that literally went around. There was a period of time in Hollywood where it was somebody had written, and I believe it was American Pie. And, you know, the guys who wrote American Pie wrote a title on the script where it's they titled American Pie a $10 million comedy that your readers are going to hate, but you're going to love. And that instantly caught people's eye, and they're like, what the, you know, that's not a title. That's just telling me what this movie is. Mm-hmm. And they picked it up. And of course they're like, holy fuck, we need to make this movie. It was a huge hit. And then titling things weird titles became something in the industry for a short period of time. It was very gimmicky, but it was really dominant. And so this was at the end of that, and it was petering out, and somebody had written a movie that was essentially putting Snakes on a Plane. And they're like, well, we'll change the title. But they called it Snakes on a Plane. It crossed Samuel L. Jackson's desk, and he's like, Snakes on a Plane? I would fucking watch that movie, so I'm going to be in that movie. And people online were the ones that made the joke that if Samuel L. Jackson's in this movie, then he's got to say, I can't wait for the moment when he says,
I have had it with these motherfucking snakes on this motherfucking plane.
And that wasn't in the script anywhere, so they had to actually go and reshoot that and slip that in to the movie so that it would be there so that the internet audiences wouldn't be disappointed. But they were going to change the name to like Flight 115 or something like that.
Yeah.
Air
Flight 121 was the working title.
And he was like, no, you're not going to fucking change the title. I got signed on to this movie because I was making Snakes on a Plane. You're going to release it as Snakes on a Plane. And it became the first real live legitimate pre-movie meme.
Yeah.
Like, it became a thing that it was everywhere, and people were like, what the fuck is this Snakes on a Plane thing? Is this real? And they're like, yeah, this is a movie that's coming out starring Samuel L. Jackson. And people would go, what does he say? I want these motherfucking snakes on my motherfucking plane. And they're like, yeah, apparently he does.
Yeah.
And
again,
and,
it just seems like a series of dares, like, oh, you think we won't do that?
Yeah.
Oh, we're going to do that.
Yeah, the movie was really reshot and adapted and made into what meme culture wanted it to be, which is part of why it didn't succeed when it came out.
Yeah.
But yeah, he very much did it because he was just like, I want to be in that movie. Of course, now his Twitter account is just kind of an unending stream of him bitching about the fact that he made that movie because he can't ever get on a plane without the pilot walking out and saying the line.
Yeah.
No, like he deals with that every time he flies.
But believe it or not, that movie is not the central focus of this episode. In fact, we're going to talk about some legit awesome and legit good Samuel L. Jackson
great
movies.
Samuel
and great,
Jackson
yes. Movies. And by, you know, starting right out of the gate with great, Long Kiss Goodnight, 1996.
Written by Shane Black.
Written by Shane Black, a movie that unfortunately when it came out was not terribly well received. I actually watched the episode of Siskel and Ebert where they talked about this movie. Not only did Ebert not like this movie, he talked some serious shit about Shane Black. Because Siskel was sitting there basically saying the things that you and I are going to say, like, no, there's some really clever writing in this. The action set pieces are really great. The characters, like, everything Siskel was saying, I was like, yeah, that's pretty much why Cargill and I love this movie. And then Ebert was like, yeah, whatever. And then Siskel's like, well, it was written by Shane Black. And he's like, psh, what did he ever write? Last Boy Scout? And I'm like, Oh, Ebert. Oh, buddy. First of all, Last Boy Scout is good. And secondly, are you just completely forgetting Lethal Weapon? Has that just completely been removed from your brain?
No, what it was at the time, there was a critical sense that Shane Black was sliding downhill. And when we go back and look at it through the lens of history, no, Shane Black consistently wrote great stuff.
Exactly.
All throughout his career and continues to write great stuff.
Yes.
Because he's Shane fucking Black. That's why. And, this was interesting because, I'd seen this. I saw this when it came out, watched it on video a lot. And then, through the Austin Film Festival and going and hanging out at the Driscoll, got to know Shane over the years. And, one year the Austin Film Festival decided to do a retrospective and show The Long Kiss Goodnight and have him do a Q&A. And he hadn't watched it since it had come out. And it was interesting to watch his reaction to it because he had forgotten how good it was. Like, he bought into the blowback from people like Ebert.
Wow.
And had bought into the idea that he had written a lackluster movie.
Bought into it so much he started to doubt his actual writing.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. And he ultimately was like, well, yeah, I'll do this, but it's not that great a movie. And then he goes and watches it, and this swelling pride rises up in him. Mm-hmm. And he's like, holy shit, I've been hating on my own movie for years and this movie's good. And then he goes and does the Q&A and people are asking questions about the various things that come up. And this movie has a really weird thing that comes up that we'll address a little later. But it was a weird, odd sense of prescience. This is one of those movies where, he just and pop culture just kind of let this movie go by and forgot that this movie's fucking badass.
This movie is so good. This script by Shane Black is so good. It makes Rennie Harlan look like a competent filmmaker.
He was occasionally a competent filmmaker.
He had brief glimpses of mediocrity. Glimpses of competence.
This movie is awesome.
No, this movie is awesome. But I'm giving that entirely credit to the Shane Black script. This movie is about a woman who is like the perfect housewife. She's a homemaker. And for 8 years, she's been living with her boyfriend and her child. And then she gets into an accident, of course, on Christmas Eve, because this is a Shane Black movie. So Christmas has to play a part at some point. And after this head injury in a car accident, she starts being able to do things she didn't know that she could do and have these flashes to this other life. And suddenly someone shows up at her house and tries to kill her, and she dispatches them. What the fuck is going on? You start to find out that she was a trained government assassin who developed this cover for herself and then got amnesia. And just, it's kind of not terribly dissimilar from the setup of Total Recall, where it's like she's just been living this fake average life so long that now that's the only life she thinks she has.
Yeah.
And doesn't even remember when she was a kick-ass spy. But before the head injury happened, she had been hiring detectives to try and help her figure out what happened to her before she got amnesia. One of those detectives is played by Samuel L. Jackson.
Samuel L., you never make an assumption because it makes an ass out of you and umption.
An umption, yes. Such a great line. That whole line where he... At the beginning of the movie, you see him bust a guy for prostitution.
No. He doesn't bust a guy for prostitution. He shakes the motherfucker down.
He shakes him down, and he's just like, if you say one more word, I will send you to jail and make sure you get ass-fucked for the next 10 years. And if you get off on some technicality, I will personally hire someone to ass-fuck you for the next 10 years. So if you're a fan of ass-fucking, say one more goddamn word. And it's just like, nobody delivers a fuck-you line.
Yeah.
Like Samuel L. Jackson. Nobody. No. And it flows like music. Like, I wait to get to the chorus where he's just going to hit that perfect pitch and deliver the hammer in a way that no one else has ever fucking done.
Yeah.
Here's how great Samuel L. Jackson is. That role was written as a white Jewish character. That role, Mitch Hennessy, whose name, by the way, was not Mitch Hennessy in the original script, was written as a part for either Matthew Broderick or Richard Dreyfuss. It was written as a kind of nebbish white Jewish guy. And Samuel L. Jackson read the script, really liked it, went in for a reading, and was so goddamn good that they were like, okay, well, we need to change the character to be a black guy so we can have Samuel L. Jackson. And then they were like, okay, well, he's the character, but in the first edit of the movie, his character dies. And they did a test screening, and the legend has it that some woman stood up and screamed, "You can't kill Samuel L. Jackson!" So Rennie Harlan re-edited the movie so that they didn't, in fact, kill Samuel L. Jackson. But he's such a great character in this because we already have our sounding board in the fact that she's slowly regaining her memories, and Brian Cox shows up as her former kind of agency boss to explain things to her.
I forgot that it was Brian Cox.
It's Brian Cox. It's Gina Davis, by the way, playing the female lead.
But putting that in historical context, she's part of the Weapon X program.
Yeah, she's part of the Weapon X program. So Stryker shows up to tell her
Stryker shows up
that she's Lady Deathstrike. And so we have our sounding board in her. So Samuel L. Jackson is like this further removed sort of sounding board who is just so goddamn funny throughout the whole movie. One of my favorite things about him is everything he's doing when he's about to like go in and you know, lay his thing down is that he does it in a blues style. So he's like, loading my gun, putting it in my pocket. Like throughout the whole movie, he's doing this. And it's so much fun to watch. And the movie itself, very cleverly written. The action sequences are a lot of fun, but it's so much better than you would think it was because of Shane Black's script and that the time he takes to develop character, to develop humor, and to add both character and humor into the peril of the action sequences. So it's not just spectacle for spectacle's sake.
Yeah. And then we get to the point that the main plot of the movie essentially mirrors 9/11 in a creepy, weird fucking way, like really close to the numbers.
I have a theory that the people who are 9/11 truthers are all just really big fans of this movie.
It's possible.
Because there's a plot where you've realized that the bad guy's ultimate plot is to cause a terrorist event, a terrorist attack, so that it looks like terrorists did it, so that they can up their own funding.
Well, and when the terrorist says jet fuel can't melt steel beams, yeah, you know, that is the big, you know,
yeah, it's, wow, it
they
is.
They don't actually say that.
They don't say that, but they do say, they do reference the first attack on the World Trade Center, and then the next line out of the guy's mouth is like, if we can't, the only thing better than faking an attack that kills that many people is to actually schedule an attack that kills that many people, and then our funding will get up. And it's so, oh my God, it's so prescient in a very odd way.
Yeah, it's in a very creepy way. And that was the weird thing, was revisiting that film after 9/11.
Yeah.
Changed the nature of that movie. And I think in a certain way made it even better, because I think maybe one of the problems that people had back when they saw it was the seeming ludicrousness of a terrorist attack of that scope.
Yeah.
And then once we'd seen that, it was like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like going back and rewatching that episode of The Lone Gunman, you know, that X-Files spinoff show, which they have an episode about flying planes into the towers. Becomes like,
yeah.
Oh, and it's just kind of chilling in a way that it wasn't when you saw it. And the movie gets so much power from that, but it gets so much power from Shane's writing. I mean, it's just so, it's such a sharp, funny fucking movie. And Samuel L. Jackson's so fucking goddamn funny in this
and
movie.
And he's funny, too, because his character, at first, you're going to think is going to be the protector. He's going to be in that role of saving her and all this other stuff. And then halfway through the movie, when she gets her memory being a spy back, he becomes kind of the damsel in distress a couple of times. And it's a really cool gender dynamic, which is funny to me because they had toyed with the idea, the original script, she was, you know, it was a female character. They toyed with the idea of changing it so it was a male character and giving it to Stallone. And I'm just like, this movie doesn't work at all if that happens.
No,
not at all.
It like, really doesn't.
Because the movie becomes its own kind of strange commentary on, you know, on gender equality, gender dynamics, what it really means for a woman to be a housewife versus being out in the career. Like, there's so many interesting subtextual things that you can take away from the story as it is that if you make that character Stallone,
and those dream sequences work. Those dream sequences wouldn't work.
No.
Because those dream sequences work in the framework of this film because we have this delightful, lovable, innocent, sweet housewife who's being tormented by her darker side.
Right.
And if you put that in context of men, it becomes an alpha male, beta male thing that just wouldn't translate in terms of that era, or I think in this era.
Yeah.
Whereas by putting that, you know, in context of a woman and how people contextualize women, it totally works.
Yeah. And from there, we need to talk about a film that I know is one of Cargill's absolute favorites, and I watched for the first time in preparation for the show, and that is a film called Eve's Bayou, which is from 1997.
Directed by Casey Lemons, who I honestly believe is one of the most underrated directors out there. She also did Caveman's Valentine, Listen to Me.
Talk to me.
Mm-hmm. Really amazingly talented director who, you know, is black woman in Hollywood. So, you know, she had to struggle to get films made. And this is her first one. And this film is a motherfucker.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what the movie's about?
Well, before we get there, I want to share my experience because this is one of those really great film experiences in my life. Back in late 97, I was dating the woman who would ultimately become my wife, but I was living here in Austin. She was going back to visit her folks for the holidays and spend a week down there. I was living alone. It was one of those loneliest weeks of my life. And I'm out shopping at the grocery store and I run into this guy that I know who's a manager of a movie theater. And he says, "Hey man, we're getting the new Tarantino film in and it opens this Christmas Eve. We have to run it through. Do you want to come in Christmas Eve and watch Jackie Brown by yourself?" And I was like, "Fuck yeah, I want to come and watch Jackie Brown by myself." So I go there, but they're going to be running it late after they close down around midnight. So I'm like, "Well, I need to be there early for a reason." I'm like, "Well, I'll go and see something else." And I see that they're playing Eve's Bayou and I'm like, "Why don't I do a Samuel L. Jackson double feature?" And so the first night I see Eve's Bayou is watching Eve's Bayou back to back with Jackie Brown.
Nice.
On Christmas Eve. And it was just as lonely and terrible as that week was, as you know, we've all had those weeks in our life. This became this bright beacon of cinema. 4 hours of just perfection that started out with Eve's Bayou. Eve's Bayou is the story of this little girl, I believe she's 10, who starts off telling you the movie, "Let me tell you the story about how I killed my father."
Yeah.
And what then follows is this very down-to-earth kind of coming-of-age story of a little girl in the South in the 1950s, whose dad is the town's most popular, wonderful doctor, and who is a philanderer fucking everything that moves,
yeah,
who is played by Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me about his character in this movie is that in every other Samuel L. Jackson role, good guy, bad guy, doesn't matter, he is always impossibly likable.
Yes.
Like, whether or not you're supposed to be rooting for him, you're rooting for him. And in Eve's Bayou,
oh, no,
he's playing this really oily, really scummy, really just, there's something just so off-putting about the
guy. He's got a beautiful wife,
yeah,
and a beautiful family.
Yeah.
And he's got a perfect practice. Everyone loves him in town, and he just can't stop fucking not only every woman in town, but everybody else's wives.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too, is like, he's charming enough to win them over, but that charm never translates out to the audience, which I think is a really great nod to the director here, is that it's kept all internally to the point that we just see it as conning them. We just see it as this long con that he plays all throughout town with these people's wives, and I didn't like him. Like, I'm not, and that's a testament to his performance.
Yeah.
Because this is a very outside of type character. You know, Samuel L. Jackson has played so many different types of characters, but they've always been likable on some level or another, which is what makes this character so outside of type for him, is that you don't like him at all.
No. And that's part of the thing that really connected me with this movie. At this era, I mean, this is late 97. Like, this is the height of the Samuel L. Jackson explosion, where he became a counterculture star. And here he is playing this role where he's not the center of the movie, although the movie revolves around him. And he is just so fucking unlikable.
Mm-hmm.
You just do not, the thing is though, that he's unlikable and yet charming. You see why everyone in town is in love with him. You see why he scores with all.
But that's
these
what
women.
I was saying. It's like the charm, I don't think, translates to the audience, which is a good thing, because if we were taken in by his charm as the audience, I don't think the movie would be half as effective.
He's what we would call in this day and age a douchebag.
Yes, he's a total douchebag. He's a
total fucking douchebag. And you just see, you're like, "Oh, I fucking hate this dude." But he nails that. Mm-hmm. He nails he nails that notion, because there's people who play the douchebag role where it's like, why would anyone fall for that? And you're like, no, I see exactly why people would fall for that, but I'm not buying his shit. Yeah. And we're not supposed to. And that's what's so fucking good about this movie and this performance. But it's also, you know, flanked by the fact that everyone in this movie is amazing. The performances in this movie, right down to the kids, like, you know who the kids are, because the kids all grew up to be, you know, talented actors in their own right. Like the eldest daughter is
Megan Good.
Megan Good, who you've seen in dozens of films and who's really a fantastic actress. And here she is, and the part she plays in this movie is so amazing and heartbreaking. And she plays into what I think the movie's biggest strength is how this movie manipulates you emotionally. Like, you get sold this image of who Samuel L. Jackson's character is in this movie, and then they go and they use that against you, and you buy into narratives that may or may not be true. And it's so well done and well crafted. It's an amazing first film. I love this movie so much. It's one of my favorite films ever made.
It's a very strange, very mystical coming of age story that is it's a conversation about memory and about how reliable memory is, but in a way that isn't. That's not really the mystery. The mystery isn't really, did it happen, how it happened. The mystery is just putting the pieces together from being told exactly what's going to happen at the end. It's a very much like the difference between, you know, a mystery versus a suspense film. We're told at the beginning, you know, much like a Hitchcock film would do, we're told exactly what's going to happen.
Yes.
And it's just kind of watching.
This is the summer that my father died.
We're watching the bricks be laid to that point. We see visions of how it's going to happen, but we only get glimpses of it. And it's just kind of connecting all the dots together. So the ending isn't a surprise. It's just the emotional impact of that event
and how it comes together
and how emotionally drained everyone is before that even happens and why they're drained. Yeah. No, I think structurally it's a very fascinating
and
way.
Then the cool genre twist to it.
Yes,
which
definitely.
I'm a huge fan of. Like, it's one of those things that we're not going to mention simply because you don't see it coming and you can't see it coming. And when it does, you realize how well Casey Lemons sets that up. And you're just like, holy shit.
Yeah.
It's so well put together. This movie, this is a craftsman-like movie.
Yeah. And from there, we're going to talk about a film from a director that we've featured not too many weeks ago in our first film series, John McTiernan, and a film
in
2003 called Basic, which I now realize came out in roughly the same era as two other John Travolta political military thrillers.
Yes.
The General's Daughter and Civil Action, I think, was the other one.
Civil Action was a little earlier, but yeah.
But it's like, I didn't actually know what Basic was about because I thought it was one of those other two movies. Basic is
Had you not seen it?
I had not seen it until this movie. Jesus. I thought I had, and then I realized, no, I've seen The General's Daughter.
Basic. Here's the thing about Basic, and here's the problem with Basic. The problem with Basic is it is a twist movie that has a number of twists to it that came out at the end of Hollywood's twist era.
It's Love Affair with M. Night Shyamalan, for example.
M. Night Shyamalan, you know, with The Sixth Sense in August of 99, that was one of the big atom bombs of the 90s, you know, where we talked about how Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs were you know, the atom bombs that ignited and altered the way we looked at character and character development in cinema in the 90s. M. Night Shyamalan with The Sixth Sense, that was an atom bomb that totally changed the way we looked at movie structure. And all of a sudden, Hollywood fell in love with the idea of the twist again. Mm-hmm. And the idea that we could, and audiences wanted the twists. Audiences, people forget that audiences got really bored with vanilla films that just wanted to tell them a film.
Right.
And in studio meetings during that era, the studio heads would be sitting there with a smile on their face going, okay, what's the twist? And if you didn't have one, there was a good chance that you weren't going to get greenlit. And so Basic is a movie that you can really tell was built around its twist. At an era where people, where the critics were just starting to go, oh, for fuck's sake, another twist. Oh, I figured this out. And it became people trying to be smarter than the filmmakers and trying to prove, rather than enjoying the movies and trying to enjoy the experience.
That they couldn't be outsmarted by a screenwriter.
That I can't be outsmarted. I can figure this out. And the thing is that Basic's twist is so fucking good.
I was going to say.
So solid.
Which one?
The final twist is so good and so solid, leading to the great final line in that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, just so good that rewatching it becomes a whole nother experience. And that's the mark of a good twist movie.
Yeah.
And this movie never got that credit.
Well, I don't want to go into, I don't want to spoil it because there's so many different layers to the complexity of the story here. The basic setup is that John Travolta, is that there has been a drill sergeant who has been murdered and
along with his team.
And the survivors of this fray have been called in for questioning, and they bring in John Travolta, who is a guy who's just really good at getting the truth. It's not unlike the character that Sam Neill plays in The Mouth of Madness. This guy's really fucking good at getting the truth out of people.
Except that I would actually compare him more in this day and age to Raylan Givens from Justified. He is this hard-drinking ex-ranger who gets called in knows he doesn't belong there, doesn't want to fucking be there, but is doing a favor for an old buddy and is just so good at his job, despite the fact that he's also so not good at his job, that, you know, he needs to be there and nobody really wants him there as much as he does.
Yeah.
And that conflict pervades the entire 2 hours of this movie.
And it's structured very, very similarly to The Usual Suspects.
Yes.
Because what we're doing is we're getting people's accounts of an event that happened, and you start questioning who's the most reliable narrator. Whereas, in Usual Suspects, we only had the one narrator, Verbal Kent. In this movie, we have several different narrators, several different versions of what happened. And that's the interesting part, is somebody's like, that's not how it happened. Here's how it happened. And every time they say that, we watch the same scene again from a different perspective with certain little, you know, modifications, little tweaks to it. And the whole time, Samuel L. Jackson plays the murdered drill sergeant. And what I love about his character is you watch his drill sergeant and you don't think R. Lee Ermey from Full Metal Jacket.
No.
You think Nick fucking Fury. If I had seen this movie right before they made the announcement that he was going to play Nick Fury, I would have been like, oh, hell yes, he should play Nick Fury.
Oh, this movie came out shortly before the original Ultimates was published. So if you saw this movie and then read the Ultimates, you were like, fuck yes, that's Nick Fury.
Yes.
That's fucking Sam Jackson from Basic. Like, he's, the opening of the movie is a helicopter flying in a fucking hurricane.
Because it's John McTiernan's
over
film.
Over the Panama Canal.
Because it's a John McTiernan film.
With fucking Samuel L. Jackson giving a fucking drill sergeant speech. And it is just, you're just like, I'm fucking in this. I'm deep in it. My wife, who had seen the movie 10 years ago, was sitting there going, I've seen this movie, but I don't remember any of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really liking this movie. And she was slowly reliving the movie because she couldn't remember how it ended. And I was like, you don't remember this ending? And I'm like, you are in for such a treat. But yeah, it opens up with just this wonderful, just like, what the fuck is going on moment. And then after that opening sequence, it's like, and they're dead.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I love too about this. You can tell within the first scene that it's a John McTiernan film because there's the little green text that comes up and tells you you're in the Panama. Yes, and then there's a helicopter full of all these like badass, soldiers, and you're like, yeah, if they go out and they hunt an extraterrestrial hunter, then yeah, this is going to be the perfect John McTiernan film. And instead, they're all hunting Samuel L. Jackson, apparently.
Yeah,
and it's so much fun to watch. It's a very twisty movie. John Travolta is apparently playing Bane because his name is Tom Hardy. And like I said, his entire goal is just to get the truth of what actually happened. And you just can't trust anyone at any time or any piece of information you've been given.
Yeah. And that is the bedrock of this movie. Like, there's not one character in this movie that doesn't lie to you at some point in time.
Right.
And it's fascinating. Like, there's, you know, and sometimes the lies are really small and sometimes they are plot bending. And it is, it's a really fascinating movie that if it were made today, the reaction to this movie would be so much different than it was in the post Shyamalan era, mm-hmm. where, you know, it was just everyone started getting tired of twists. People aren't tired of twists anymore because we don't get them as much because people appreciate straightforward storytelling again. Mm-hmm. But this movie is a great twist movie of that era. I think the twist of this movie is better than 90% of the other twist movies out there from that era.
Yeah. Because, you know, it's the title kind of refers to the fact that even when you get to the heart of 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 what's really going on, it's pretty straightforward. Pretty straightforward what's actually happening. It's just been cloaked in layer after layer after layer after layer of bullshit and retelling in the most advantageous light. Like, just it's so interesting the way this is structured.
Also interesting, you will not find a movie in which Samuel L. Jackson is more mythic looking than this fucking movie. Like, the way he walks in that black beret and that cape,
yeah,
with the wind blowing, like, that was such an iconic moment in the movie. They're like, we have to put that on the fucking poster. It's not gonna make any fucking sense,
yeah,
but we're putting that on the poster because you're just like, fuck.
Well, my first reaction when I started watching this movie was, oh, he's not in it that much because, you know, they kill him, he's dead, whatever. And then it's like, oh, we get to see that story again from all these different perspectives. Yes. He's still in the movie a lot, and he's still as magnetic as ever.
And that the night you were watching that made me so happy because I get this text in the middle of the night that just says, so pretty, so dead. And I'm just like, it just made me smile. I'm like, oh, he is learning the joy of basic.
Yeah.
This makes me this, because sometimes that happens where I'm like, hey, when we do this, you got to watch this, you got to watch this, and you do the same thing to me. And this was one of those movies where I was like, oh, we got to talk about basic. And you were like, oh, I haven't seen it. So I had my fingers crossed that you would love it. Mm-hmm. Like, you didn't love Eve's Bayou as much as I did.
Not quite, no.
But you loved basic as much as I did.
Yeah, I loved basic.
And so when you texted me that in the middle of the night, I was like, oh, fuck yes.
It's part of that is that, you know, you have Samuel L. Jackson, you have John Travolta, but you have a fucking amazing cast all around.
And oh, God. And in it, you know, back when some of these guys were riding high and some of these people were not nearly as big as they would be now.
Yeah.
You know, like a young Taye Diggs.
Young Taye Diggs, like, Giovanni Ribisi.
Well, Giovanni Ribisi, this was the era where Giovanni Ribisi was the big, hip, indie actor. You know, mm-hmm. he'd been on Friends several times as Phoebe's brother, and he'd been on in several movies, and he was the guy you got when you needed that kind of weird indie actor that was kind of a B-list mainstream actor, but also a cool indie actor.
Yeah.
But someone like Taye Diggs, you know,
Rosalind Sanchez.
Yes.
Tim Daly, Harry Connick Jr. Like,
oh yeah. And that was them. That was bringing those guys back. And Harry Connick Jr. is great in this. And Tim Daly, that was like, where the fuck have you been, Tim Daly?
Seriously. And where has he been since this is the other question I have.
Living high off all that basic money.
I got basic money, y'all. No, this is a really great film that doesn't allow you to rest in the laurels of figuring out one twist.
No.
And that is what's really interesting about it. And Samuel L. Jackson is so amazing as a drill sergeant that I don't know why he doesn't play drill sergeants in more movies, except that I feel like he's kind of fallen into that mode now with the Nick Fury character. And again, when you watch Basic and you hear the way he talks to his soldiers, you're like, yeah, that's fucking Nick Fury.
Yeah.
Like, that's him basically auditioning to play Nick Fury at some point in the future. And we all know how that turned out. So from there, we're going to do a quick lightning round, because
lightning round,
we could sit here all goddamn day and talk about,
we'd have an 8-hour podcast, we would have about an 8-hour everything podcast. We love about Samuel L. Jackson,
and that's, you know, that's why, again, I feel like of course he's right for the best black character actor discussion, because so many of these roles are not leads, so many of these roles are him coming in and delivering an amazing performance, sometimes all too briefly,
like Kill Bill
for example,
where he's the piano player
in volume 2 for 5 minutes,
but you know what, it's fucking great.
It is indeed. And I also want to talk about Kiss of Death, Kiss of Death is this 90s...
You talk about Kiss of Death. I know you do.
Love this movie.
This is one of those rare times where we talk about something that we disagree on. I'm not on the Kiss of Death
train. It's a mid-90s film noir starring David Caruso, long before he was Horatio Caine on CSI Miami.
But after, you know, this is after he left NYPD Blue to go off for his big movie career, which was one of the first great first season jokes on South Park. Hey, I do your David Caruso career. It's my turn. Bump.
Unfair. It's unfair, and I will say this. Kiss of Death is a really outstanding, really fun film noir. If you think of film noir in terms of, if you imagine that every character that is written into a film noir is written by someone who received a transmission that was beamed through the cosmos and reached them, you know, light years after film noir was a thing, and they pretty much understood it, but didn't fully understand it. So they write characters that are so weirdly exaggerated that what it turns into is a crime film from another dimension. And that's what I love about it. Because first of all, you have Nicolas Cage as the son of the local mobster playing a character who routinely bench presses strippers. Like, that's how he stays in shape. He just bench presses these strippers, and he's a complete roided out psychopath. And his dad, played by Philip Baker Hall, is the more like, will you just shut up and do your job, for God's sake? Stop screaming, stop fighting people, whatever. David Caruso is an ex-con who's trying to go straight, but he's got that fuck-up friend. And that fuck-up friend is played, you know, by a character actor who plays a lot of fuck-up friends in Michael Rapaport.
I think you've defied the rules of the lightning round at this point.
I'm sorry. But yeah. Kiss of Death. Really fun movie. Exaggerated characters to the nth degree. And what's great is that when you have all these exaggerated characters in the film, the center, the completely calm and focused center of this crazy universe is Samuel L. Jackson as the detective who wants to bring down Nicolas Cage's little junior Bonner. Or, I'm sorry, little junior Brown. And I'm like, I'm sorry, you hire Samuel L. Jackson, and he's the guy who's the most even-keeled throughout the whole movie? Samuel L. Jackson, who we've come to know and love, is the guy who screams profanity like nobody else, is the, like, calm, collected, we're going to do this, and there's nothing you can do about it. And he's the most rational, sane person in the movie. It is such an interesting turn for him, because everyone else, Nicolas Cage is screaming and being insane, and Samuel L. Jackson can just be like, yeah, but I'm going to arrest you and fuck all of you. I don't even have to raise my voice. It's amazing. It's amazing to watch.
Yeah. Let's run through the litany of ones we don't need to discuss.
Okay.
Pulp Fiction.
Don't need to discuss Pulp Fiction.
Fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Jurassic Park.
Don't need to discuss it.
Really, you know, he that
hang
was
on
like
to your butts.
That is where people first saw him and got to know him. Like, the thing about Samuel L. Jackson is he was a character actor for a long time. You know, he'd shown up in some Spike Lee stuff. He, you know, Jungle Fever.
Coming to America.
You know, and he was, you know, one of those character actors that had just gotten old enough that it was like, this
hell,
is
Goodfellas.
Yeah.
He has a small role in fucking Goodfellas in 1990.
He hit that point where it was like, it's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. Like, he hit that age where it's like, never going to happen. And this is why we talk about him being a character actor, because that was the start of his career. And he hit that age in the mid-40s where it's like, it's just, you know, you're never going to be a leading man. You're never going to be Denzel Washington. You're never going to be Wesley Snipes. And then Pulp Fiction drops and and then all of a sudden, the end of his career is just amazing and filled with all these great character roles, some kind of lead roles, but mostly character stuff.
In one movie, he goes from being a guy not getting the respect he deserves to being an Oscar-nominated actor.
Yes.
In one movie, completely changes everything for him.
Yeah. Now, what I will talk about that I love that I don't think gets enough love, Black Snake fucking Moan.
Oh my God, Black Snake Moan is great.
It's a great movie. Like, it's one of those things that it was like everybody collectively put their heads up their ass about Craig Brewer. Craig Brewer is a fucking brilliant filmmaker.
Hustle and Flow, I've said it before, I will say it again, it's the hip-hop Rocky.
It is fucking amazing. And then to go to Black Snake Moan, and then his flash dance is fantastic.
You mean Footloose?
Footloose.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. This is this is four beers and three recordings in.
Yes, sir.
And Footloose becomes Flash Dance because fuck it. That's why. No, but yeah, Footloose. His Footloose is really good. Like, and it's one of those things where it's like, how do you remake kind of a classic 80s thing that you can't, okay, you did it. And he's somebody who should be making tons of fucking movies, but everybody put their head up their ass because they took one look at the exploitation nature of the poster of Black Snake Moan, and they were like, I don't like the idea of the big scary black man with a chained up white girl. And it's like, when you watch the movie, it's like, holy shit, you do.
Yeah.
Like that, this movie's so good and so profound and amazing. And it was one of those things that it showed up at Putnamathon, and we just walked out and we were just like, fucking Sam Jackson finally got his Oscar.
Yeah.
Like, this is it. This is that performance. He's so good. The scene in which he's playing blues
in the storm,
a fucking thunderstorm. Yeah. It's like, holy shit.
It's the moment you realize what the whole movie is about, which is about this, like, really dark and painful, cathartic nature of the blues. That movie does for the blues what Hustle and Flow did for hip hop.
Yeah. And then everybody was just like, pfft. And then Sam shit on it. Like, yeah, it was one of those things where, I saw him on a talk show, like after that came out, and he was like, yeah. And Black Snake Moan, he's like, you know, you take one look at that poster, it's like, what were you thinking? You know, I don't even know why I did that movie. And it's just like, oh, Sam, no. That's like one of the best performances of your career. God damn.
Yeah.
And like, even when he distanced himself from that movie, and I met Craig Brewer, and he's a fucking sweet guy, and he's talented as fuck. And it's like, why did this movie not connect with people? Mm-hmm. If you've never seen Black Snake Moan, that is the lesson to learn from tonight, is to go and fucking watch that. Yeah. If you're a Sam Jackson fan and haven't seen that one, that movie is really fucking good. And if you're like sitting there going, no, dude, Cargill, Brian, you guys are wrong, that movie's not that good, go back and rewatch it and then tell us how bad it is. Because I disagree with you strongly and think that the second watch is really going to connect with you.
Absolutely.
So other light, let's try to stick with the lightning round concept.
Come on!
That we've thrown completely out the fucking window at this point.
We've thrown a little bit out the window. I'm always going to love, and I don't care how bad the movie is itself, I'm always going to love his turn as Hondo from SWAT.
Oh, yes.
SWAT is so much fun.
It's not a good movie.
It's not a good movie at all, but if you really want to understand where Samuel L. Jackson's Nick Fury came from, take his drill sergeant from Basic and his Hondo from SWAT, put those two together, and what you've got is his Nick Fury. I love that. And you know what? Not only that, but he's the
that
boss.
That was the movie that made everybody pretend that they'd actually seen SWAT.
Yes.
The TV show.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, everyone's like, oh, I love SWAT. It's like, you've never fucking watched that show.
Well, and not only that, but the Nick Fury thing's even more apt when you think about the fact that under his command was Jeremy Renner. So he was already working with Hawkeye in that movie.
That's right.
Yeah.
Fuck.
That was Jeremy Renner's big breakout movie.
I need to go and rewatch SWAT now.
When he got that movie, Jeremy Renner was still going to telephone post, putting up posters that he had made for the movie Dahmer, like trying to get people to go see the movie Dahmer when he got the role
when
in SWAT.
When this was made, people still thought Colin Farrell was going to be one of the greatest actors of his generation.
Which is so sad, because once he stopped doing like box office bullshit, he became a really great actor.
He is. He's always been talented, and he just got caught up in being an A-list star.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about Colin Farrell or Jeremy Renner.
Talking about Samuel L. Jackson. Yeah, and he is just a no-nonsense, I don't take your shit, and I definitely don't take the shit of people above me, SWAT commander, who puts together a ragtag team of guys, and also Michelle Rodriguez, who just proceed to kick ass.
All right, but
for 2 hours.
I'm going to have to peel back the curtain a bit. Just for a second.
Okay.
Are we posting this particular one the following day, or is this one of those that's going to be posted a little later?
Well, this is going to be next. The one we recorded before will go before that.
Okay. And one. So this past weekend.
There you go.
Kingsman came out. Now, I saw this a couple months ago. If you have not seen Kingsman yet, you need to go and see Kingsman for a number of reasons, and Samuel L. Jackson is one of them. Samuel L. Jackson goes fucking nuts in this movie. Now, Brian, have you seen this yet?
I have not seen this
yet. Holy shit.
Not at the time of this recording.
Holy shit. Kingsman, he decides, essentially Kingsman, what it is to tie together last week's episode and this week's episode. It is essentially a movie in which Matthew Vaughn made a Roger Moore-style era Bond movie with Colin Firth as an aging Bond teaching a new young Bond the ropes, with Samuel L. Jackson playing the lispy villain. And he talking with a lisp, and wonderfully so.
Huh.
And he plays the classic crazy Bond villain in a wonderful way. And he is having so much fun chewing up the scenery. And you can tell he's having fun. And that's what he talked about when he came in and spoke at Bunnumathon this year.
I feel like there's something kind of pseudo autobiographical about that. Because one thing I didn't know about Samuel L. Jackson until I did research for this episode, he had a really bad stutter as a kid, and the way he finally overcame it is he literally just learned to use the word motherfucker when he would start to stutter, and it became a way that he overcame his stutter, is he just started saying motherfucker.
That makes me so happy.
And there's so many interesting things about his life. He played French horn. He wanted to be a marine biologist. He had a stutter as a kid that he overcame by swearing. This is a human being as awesome as the characters he plays, and that's so refreshing that, like, that's just him. Just who he is. I'm sorry.
But Kingsman is one of the most fun films I've seen in a couple years.
Awesome.
Like, it is we normally don't talk about new films in junk food cinema, but Kingsman is going to be a junk food cinema classic 10, 20 years from now. It's going to be one of those, you haven't seen Kingsman. Holy shit. Yeah. Sit down and watch fucking Kingsman. Now, I hope to God that movie hits and people love it, because it's so much fun.
Totally.
And actually, there was a movie that came out about 10 years ago called Devil's Rejects that used the song Freebird,
mm-hmm,
in a way that I was like, nobody can ever use this again. Like, they own Freebird now. Matthew Vaughn fucking took it back.
Matthew Vaughn, much like Samuel L. Jackson, does not play by your rules.
He took it back, and it's like, holy shit, Kingsman now owns. Like, I feel like Freebird is now a torch to be passed every decade or so to a new movie figures out a brilliant way to use it.
No, because then producers are going to be shouting like drunk people at Lynyrd Skynyrd concerts.
Freebird! Can we fit Freebird into this? Like, I'll have that script meeting eventually where it's like, okay, this is great, but where's the Freebird moment?
Yeah. And then, of course, I feel like we would be totally remiss in our duties if we didn't at least mention a little film called Deep Blue Sea, which brings this episode full circle because it's also directed by Rennie Harlan. Was last Long Kiss Goodnight.
Because, you know, some of Rennie Harlan's best movies are Samuel L. Jackson movies.
That's true. This movie, first of all, I will maintain until the day that I die, is way better if you think of it from the shark's perspective as a prison break movie. It's so much better. It's the Shark Tank Redemption. That's exactly what you're watching.
I disagree. I love this movie for so many other reasons.
It's like when you play
what you're doing.
You play the modern Jaws video game and you realize that part of the objective is just to eat stupid swimmers. I feel like that's what this movie is. It's a bunch of sharks who have been manipulated by science to be super smart, and who are just eating throwaway cast member after throwaway cast member.
The brilliance of Deep Blue Sea, and I am not exaggerating.
You said
term.
That in a sentence.
I said that in a sentence, and
you
I'm
said
going to hold up.
The brilliance of Deep Blue Sea.
The brilliance of Deep Blue Sea is an anarchistic Hollywood film. It is a film that deliberately says, see all these stereotypes of these kinds of movies? We're going to flip them. Anyone who does anything heroic but stupid dies.
Mm-hmm.
You see that character that always dies first in the movie, the jive talking black guy? He's actually going to be smart and hide and live. But you know, this heroic character who's going to swim in to save another person, she's going to get eaten. And this person doing something heroic, they're going to get eaten. The only people who are going to survive are the people who are the cliches, who are always the first to die and live because they were smart and did the things the audience are screaming at the screen to do. Mm-hmm. The brilliance of this movie, it is so subversive in the fact that it pays off the audience's desires and what they want to see people doing, and then pays off in that when the audience goes, no, don't jump into the water to save him, the shark is right there, the shark just goes, gulp. Do you think she was the protagonist? Because she's not.
Yeah. The whole thing about Samuel L. Jackson's role in this movie may lend a little bit of credibility to the anarchy theory, because he stands there and gives this this description of a time, this monologue about a time he was buried in an avalanche, in this hopeless situation.
I am a survivor.
And he uses that voice of his, the shouting, and the, you know, you rally behind him as he's like,
"We're going to pull together, and we're going to find a way to get out of here."
And then a shark
jumps out of the water and snatches that motherfucker into midway through his speech.
"We're going to seal off this..."
The hope that any character should have had at that moment was dashed by the fact that it's just like, and gone.
That moment is the moment where the film signifies its treaties, where it's just like, there are no rules in this. And you ultimately find out that there are, but the rules are anyone who does the smart stuff survives, and anybody who does the movie shit dies.
Yeah. I think
that's the nature of Deep Blue Sea, and what I think is genius about it, because it is so deliberately subversive. This didn't happen by accident. This was written to be a big middle finger to the whole series of pissed off nature movies and Hollywood movies of the 80s and early 90s that played by this formula that if you gave the big rousing speech, if you died, you had to die in a noble way. Otherwise, you were going to survive. But Samuel L. Jackson is just like, I'm giving the big speech about gulp.
Yeah.
And he's gone.
And it's, I don't mean to bring everything back to the Marvel Universe, but it is kind of interesting how many people in this movie have been in Marvel movies. Yeah. Because you have Thomas Jane, who played the Punisher. You have Samuel L. Jackson, who plays Nick Fury. Yep. Saffron Burroughs has a role on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Yep. Stellan Skarsgård is in the Thor movies. Yep. It's like, what's happening here? What am I looking at? When are we going
arguably, the Thomas Jane's Punisher does not exist in MCU 199999.
So when you said arguably, you meant giant nerdily. He does not exist.
That Punisher is not the Punisher that would theoretically exist within the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It does have the Marvel logo at the beginning.
Technically,
but it's
none
not
of the
Marvel
Punishers
universe.
Exist in the Marvel Cinematic
that
Universe.
That is correct. They have not introduced the Punisher yet in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
And it needs to be Ray Winstone, because Punisher Warzone's good, and I don't care what anybody fucking says.
What do you mean anybody? Everybody loves fucking Punisher Warzone.
No, they
Warzone.
Don't. I've heard nothing but shit from people outside
everybody
of this
Everybody loves
room.
Punisher Warzone.
No, they don't. We love genius. It. And it's great, but that doesn't mean everybody loves it. Samuel L. Jackson, on the other hand, is somebody that everybody loves.
Yes.
Because no matter the greatness, no matter the shittiness of the movie that he's in, you are always going to remember his character, even if that character is killed off very quickly. Yeah. Or if that character seems like they're going to stick around and is then killed. Doesn't matter.
And especially in the 90s, he got us to watch a lot of bullshit movies that weren't any good, but that we just watched for him.
Exactly.
Like, what was that one? Formula 51?
Let's not speak of Formula 51. Yeah,
it's not a good... It's Samuel L. Jackson in a kilt.
Yeah, no thank you.
But we watched it. Why? Because Samuel L. Jackson was in it. Because exactly. If you put his name on a movie... Even if it's with Eugene Levy, we'll fucking watch the movie.
Even if it's a 747 full of snakes.
Hey, no. Let us enjoy.
We're still going to watch it, even though
it's shitty. We're still going to watch Snakes on a Plane isn't good, but at least it's fun. It pays off. It delivers.
And that brings us, of course, to our junk food pairing, which absolutely positively has to be the Big Kahuna Burger. Now, that...
is a tasty burger.
Now, before you poo-poo this choice on the trifling contention that Big Kahuna Burger doesn't actually exist, that burger is the centerpiece of a scene in a film that redefined Samuel L. Jackson's entire career. I mean, a year after taking a big, intimidating chomp out of that tasty burger, he got the second lead in Die Hard with a Vengeance, followed almost immediately by A Time to Kill. I mean, you want to talk about the movies that really kind of turned the tide. It starts with Pulp Fiction. With Matthew McConaughey. It starts with taking a bite out of that Big Kahuna Burger. He brings something fresh and distinctive to any role, big or small, that he plays. Just like the idea of putting pineapple on a burger is fresh and distinctive. Which, by the way, many of the make-your-own Big Kahuna Burger DIY sites have suggested is in fact a key ingredient. Which would make sense, because that's that Hawaiian burger joint.
Mind if I Have some of your tasty beverage to wash this down.
So that's going to do it for our episode on Samuel L. Jackson. Thank you so much for joining us on this motherfucking adventure. I hope you enjoyed it. And to let you know, once again, we are available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher, and a lot of the movies we talked about are also available on Amazon. And if you're going to buy them, please use the links that we've provided above. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And Cargill, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on facebook.com/massandworm. That's MASSAWYRM on this motherfucking plane. Or you can find me at Twitter at massandworm on this motherfucking plane.
Nice. And you can find me at Bryguy motherfucking Salisbury on Twitter. You can also like my page on Facebook, which is facebook.com/BrianSalisbury bad motherfucker
motherfucking plane
on this mother bad motherfucker on this motherfucking plane. You can also check me out over at oneofus.net. lots of great motherfucking podcasts and motherfucking geek blogs over there, so definitely check that out. And for Cargill, this is Brian signing off by reminding you that no matter where you are or how certain you are of your surroundings, always watch out for sharks.